We've got the Recovery Zone. Today, Stephanie Potter will be speaking about peace parks and rainforests with her guests from Conservation International. That's coming right up. This KABU program has been made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from Hopworks Urban Brewery, committed to creating world-class food and organic beer as sustainably as possible at their carbon-neutral eco brew pubs. Hopworks is located at Southeast 29th and Powell Boulevard, and Hopworks Bike Bar is at North Williams and Shaver, available on draft and in bottles throughout Cascadia. Information at 503-232-HOPS or hopworksbeer.com. Also by The Garden Spout, specializing in indoor gardening equipment, including horticultural lighting, environmental control, hydroponic and organic nutrients, and pest control. The Garden Spout is located at Southeast, 4532 Southeast 63rd, just south of Foster in Portland. Information at 503-788-GROW.
Hi, you're tuned to KBOO Portland. I'm Stephanie Potter, and this is The Recovery Zone, a show focused on healing our world. Today I have two guests that I'll be speaking with. First, Todd Walters, and later Jorge Ahumada. Anyway, Todd Walters is going to be talking to us about peace parks, and it sounds like a really interesting thing that he's into. He's executive director of International Peace Park Expeditions, and he's also a first fellow at the Policy Center for Environment and Peace at Conservation International. And I've got you on the phone, right, Todd?
Yes, I'm here, Stephanie.
Okay, great. And where are you talking to us from, by the way?
I'm based in Washington, D.C.
Okay, you're in Washington right now. But it sounds like you travel all over the world with the work that you're doing.
Yes, I recently returned from South Korea, where there was the Convention on Biological Diversity, which is a multilateral treaty for 120 countries from around the world that are working to protect and conserve biodiversity. And while I was there, I presented a statement on the value of transboundary protected areas or international peace parks as a tool for biodiversity conservation and building peace between North and South Korea using the Korean demilitarized zone.
Yeah, I want to get into that, but I want to just first start with, like, what got you interested in this whole, basically, you're working with the environment and you're also working as a peace builder. What got you interested in all of this?
Sure. It happened about 10 years ago when I was in graduate school here in Washington, D.C., at the School of International Service at American University. And I was pursuing a master's in international peace and conflict resolution and global environmental policy. And while I was there, I started to recognize the intersection of these two fields and this really unique and interesting niche that it created around the topic of utilizing the environment as a tool for peace building and conflict resolution.
Yeah, it sounds like pretty incredible. I mean, like basically, you're creating peace parks where people have had a lot of hostilities. And could you tell us a little bit exactly what is this transboundary protected area or a peace park?
Sure. A peace park is essentially an area between two more countries that is an overlapping protected area zone. So national parks in two or more countries that come up to the border and then overlap the border between the two countries. And the park system is collaboratively managed from a ecosystem perspective between the two countries and used as a tool for building frameworks of collaboration between people that live in and around the park systems, between scientists that work and study the forestry and biodiversity and hydrology of the ecosystem, and between the park rangers and park administrators themselves, and then on the national level between the ministries of the environment and development of those countries. And so it's really utilizing this area, which spans political boundaries, as a tool for environmental cooperation between lots of different layers of people.
And you became a fellow with Conservation International's Policy Center for this. How did that happen?
That was actually a very fortuitous opportunity for me, where a number of my colleagues were advising Conservation International at the creation of the center, and recommended that I would be a strong fit for the position. And I spoke with Conservation International on a couple of different occasions about different projects that we were working on and how it intersected with their goals and objectives for the new policy center. And at the beginning of this past year, I was offered the fellow position.
And what do you actually do as a fellow?
Sure. So I basically help facilitate relationship building between Conservation International and organizations that are in the field of environmental peace building and networks that are parts of professional organizations that contribute to environmental peace building. And so that's really the first main thing, is introducing them and connecting them to experts and organizations in the environmental peacebuilding field. And then second is working internally within Conservation International to help provide awareness raising for Conservation International staff, both in the headquarters and in the 40-plus countries around the world where Conservation International operates, holding events and meetings and bringing in guest speakers and giving presentations myself about the ways that the work that they're already doing in community-based conservation and science-based advocacy and influencing national and international policy can be consciously harnessed as a tool for environmental peace building.
Okay, so let's get back to you were in Korea, and I guess the idea there is that they're going to try to have a peace park in the demilitarized zone there. Could you talk a little about that? Like how that
Sure.
would actually, I mean, is that actually happening, or is it still just an idea, for instance?
Sure. So the Korean demilitarized zone was established 61 years ago, and it runs 155 miles directly across the Korean Peninsula, and it's a 4 kilometer wide strip.
That'd be about 2 miles?
Yes, exactly. And that is actually the most heavily militarized border in the world. There's huge fence systems. There's a number of areas where landmines are still in place. And it's patrolled by soldiers from both sides and the international community through the United Nations.
Yeah, and actually I just read on the news that there, in the last month, there have been a couple of shots fired back and forth. Even now, that's still happening, right? I guess some fellow is trying to send leaflets over into North Korea, and that's upsetting them. And then when they approach too closely, the South Koreans might fire on the North Korean soldiers.
Yes, it's been a disputed area, for those entire 61 years. And there are sort of small-scale skirmishes which still happen when different incidents like you're talking about occur. But the opportunity here is that because it's a militarized border and there isn't a lot of human impact on the landscape inside the border for the past 60 years, that it's really allowed the ecosystem to regenerate and rebuild habitat for endangered species and migratory birds, and really created an opportunity for ecological cooperation between North and South Korea, where military and economic and diplomatic cooperation is still a very difficult proposition. And so this presents a sort of an easy way to begin conversations about cooperation between the two countries.
And so basically, it's got a lot of animals in it that might not have been there otherwise. Could you talk about some of them and how that, or and the tree? I mean, what is this biodiversity that's there?
Sure. So there's a number of different species which have been returned to the zone that weren't there prior to the impact of the war. The big ones that always draw a lot of attention are the sandhill crane population. There's a number of initiatives to reintroduce tiger species to the area.
Wow.
There are falcons and different types of mountain goats which have returned to the region, and a specific type of water deer that utilizes the river systems that actually cross the boundary from North and South Korea.
And are the Koreans on both sides pretty interested in making this happen? I mean, you said the economic things kind of falter, the military, but is this something that somehow they can both embrace, love, whatever?
It's an opportunity for that. And so there's been cooperation on the small scale on a couple of different levels. The first has been scientists which are studying the ecology of the ecosystem on either side of the border have been able to share their research and their findings with each other, but they haven't yet been able to actively collaborate on joint projects together. And then there's been a number of different sites along the area just outside the demilitarized zone called the civilian control zone, where there have been the development of observation towers to encourage wildlife viewing and bird migration viewing, as well as sites that are utilized for educational purposes that are bringing students from the two countries to be able to learn about the area itself and the history. And so there's been some small-scale cooperation that's happened already. And then on the larger scale, there is an international organization called the DMZ Forum, which is comprised of experts from around the world that are interested in transboundary conservation and environmental peacebuilding, that has been working for about 10 years to try and act as an intermediary between the two governments to create the opportunity for the DMZ to serve as an international peace park between the two countries and to create more active cooperation that's on a much larger scale than is already happening.
It sounds like it's got a lot of potential to be incredibly beautiful, and that's where you said you just were giving a talk. You were in Korea at this convention, or?
Yes, it's a stunningly beautiful area. There's a number of different ecosystems throughout the area, from high alpine mountains to transition zones to protected wetlands and a number of field and prairies, and as well as both coastal ecosystems. And so it really is a unique place on the planet. And because it's been protected in this way through militarization, it was not specifically protected for biological diversity conservation, but that's been sort of one of the dividends that has come out of the militarization of the border. And now there's the hope to utilize efforts to create the peace park and transboundary cooperation around these types of conservation issues to help demilitarize that border and use it to build peace.
Yeah, it sounds like that in another 2 weeks, the World Parks Congress in Sydney, in Australia, you're going to be doing a workshop there with Conservation International, and what's that going to be all about?
Sure. So every 10 years, the International Union for the Conservation of Nature, or the IUCN, hosts this World Parks Congress, and it brings together ministers of the environment, national park and protected areas, managers and rangers, and all sorts of international and national organizations that are involved in the conservation of protected areas around the world. And it is held once a decade, and it really sets the conservation agenda for the next 10 years of how to manage and strategize and cooperate and utilize these protected areas to support biodiversity conservation and conservation of ecosystems and habitat around the world. And so I'll be presenting on a panel with Conservation International and the International Institute for Sustainable Development and the Wildlife Conservation Society, speaking on conservation and peace-building tools and practice. And it'll be on November 14th at 2 p.m., and you can find out more on the IUCN's website, iucn.org.
Okay, I just want to let listeners know you're tuned to KBOO Portland. I'm Stephanie Potter, and I'm speaking with Todd Walters. He's really involved with creating peace parks and doing peace-building strategies with Conservation International. And you've also, though, you founded something called the International Peace Parks Expeditions. It sounds like you like to just get out there, you know, basically, and go hiking. Could you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. So International Peace Park Expeditions really utilizes field-based experiential learning to teach environmental peace building. And so we partner with universities to get students out into the field and, like you said, get our boots dirty, throw the backpacks on, and explore these transboundary conservation areas or international peace parks. But we also build in a really strong academic component that focuses on the literature. It brings in experts from the region that are working on environmental peacebuilding initiatives, and they give guest lectures at the sites of their different projects in the field. And so we learn about transboundary water management and projects to combat illegal logging and poaching and the development of ecotourism initiatives and how all of these contribute to cross-border cooperation for conservation and peace building.
And you have, like, could you give some examples of some of the places where you've done these expeditions?
Sure. So the place we've been working the longest is in the Balkans region.
The Balkans.
Southeastern Europe, which is just to the east of Italy. And it's the area between Kosovo, Albania, and Montenegro.
Yeah.
And your listeners may remember the conflict that occurred in the 1990s with the Serbians and Slobodan Milosevic, and the region that was formerly Yugoslavia breaking up into a number of new countries. And Kosovo and Montenegro are two of the world's newest countries, just gaining their independence in 2008 and 2006, respectively. And then Albania in the early 1990s actually achieved the elimination of the communist dictatorship, which was in the region since World War II. And so they are establishing themselves on the world stage as well. And they're utilizing this international peace park between three countries to build up economic opportunities for their people, to be able to protect the portion of their land that's on their borders and build cooperation around that as all three of them look to gain entry into the European Union and into NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization.
So what does it look like exactly? It's like a sort of forest in the mountains kind of thing that is just sort of designated as a peace park and people don't really bother it, or sort of like the DMZ, or, I mean, how does it look, or what exactly is that peace park?
Sure. So that's one of the things that really fascinates me about international peace parks, is that they're a concept that's applied differently all over the world, and they can work in all sorts of different ecosystems, whether it's a marine peace park in the Gulf of Mexico between Guatemala, Belize, and Honduras, or whether it's the park that we're describing in the Balkans, which is in the high alpine mountain region. There's a number of sort of limestone peaks that are forming the spine of the Balkans Peninsula, and they're surrounded by pine forest, and they're one of the last biodiversity habitats in Europe, and they provide the water systems for the three different countries. And so it's a really unique, one of the last sort of biodiversity hotspots. And so for that reason, there has been a movement since independence to protect it. And so each of the three countries have worked at their own pace to create their own national park systems and dedicate a national park in this region that comes up to the border of the other two countries. And then they've actively worked in the past 2 years to link those national park systems across the borders in a regional park system so that they can share the management of those resources, they can share the training of their park staff, they can share the opportunity for ecotourism development and livelihood creation for the people that live in and around this region in the valleys around the mountains.
It sounds beautiful, but do they run into challenges where one country wants it one way and the other wants it a different way? I mean, how do they, are they basically all getting along anyway?
Sure. No, it's definitely something that is not an easy process. It's something that was initially started in 2002 and was just an idea that was brought to the region. And at that time, you know, Montenegro still didn't have its independence from Serbia, and Kosovo was still being managed by the United Nations. And it was a situation where they recognized the value of the region, but they couldn't actively do anything to formally dedicate it and create it as a peace park. And so at the government level, and what actually happened is that civil society and community organizations, primarily mountaineering organizations, began to look for ways to protect this area because they loved it. They enjoyed living and working in and around it. They enjoyed the recreation opportunities that it provided, and they recognized the uniqueness of what they had. And so they began creating an informal system of cooperation across the borders between mountaineering organizations. And this framework got picked up by some international organizations that were working to help do reconstruction and development efforts after the war. And they funded all sorts of projects that built up infrastructure in the region and helped create a framework for collaboration around ecotourism development and setting up a trail network that crosses the borders in the three national parks with the guest houses and training guides and being able to start to put into place an infrastructure that would allow the people that lived in and around the region to directly benefit from conservation efforts in the region. And so they would support initiatives that would help the transboundary cooperation. And that led to those organizations putting pressure on their national governments to formally dedicate the park systems. And then the national governments recognized the opportunity as they wanted to become members of the European Union. And part of the process of becoming a member means that you have to protect a certain amount of your landmass as protected areas, and you have to work to create peace and stability with your neighboring countries. And so this type of a project allowed them to sort of meet multiple objectives at the same time. And so in the past few years, they've really started to create a structure that utilizes the framework that was established originally between the mountaineering organizations and has now grown into, you know, multiple layers of society.
And peace parks are happening, as you say. It's not just the Balkans or hopefully in the DMZ in Korea, but I guess there's a peace park in Lake Titicaca in Africa. And we even have peace parks here in the U.S. between us and Canada and between us and Mexico.
Yeah, so the Lake Titicaca is a transboundary lake in South America between Peru and Bolivia.
Oh, sorry, in South America, right.
Yep, and it's an area where there's it's the highest alpine lake in the world at over 14,000 feet elevation, and it is the primary water source for the national capitals of both of the countries. And so they've created a transboundary water resource management regime that utilizes scientific cooperation and economic cooperation and even military cooperation, using the two navies of the two countries to be able to gather the scientific data on the lake. And then that's created a situation where they actually passed the exact same law in both of their congresses to, you know, to create this transboundary water resource management regime around the lake. And so both countries protect those resources. And then here in the United States, we have Waterton Glacier International Peace Park, which connects Glacier National Park in Montana with Waterton Lakes National Park in Alberta, Canada. And it's actually the world's first international peace park.
Huh.
And it was formally dedicated in 1932. And it is jointly managed by the U.S. National Park Service and Parks Canada. And they cooperate on a whole host of different issues, from invasive species management to fighting forest fires to search and rescue capabilities to scientific cooperation of monitoring species and looking at the impacts of climate change. And so they're sort of one of the examples which is held out around the world as a way to create peace through environmental cooperation and utilizing some of the frameworks that were established in Waterton Glacier to provide example structures for other countries that are seeking to create peace parks in their own countries.
It sounds like it's almost like something to dissolve borders eventually. I mean, how nature herself, who doesn't have any borders, could teach that lesson to human beings a little. I mean, I like that
that's
idea.
That's a phenomenal insight. No, that's a phenomenal insight. That's one of the key things within the idea of environmental peace building is looking at things from an ecosystem perspective. So just as you highlighted, the animals migrate across the border all the time, and
right,
they don't know that it's a political boundary. And, you know, the water that falls in the mountains, you know, in Waterton Glacier actually flows from Triple Divide Peak. So there's some water that gets into the Missouri-Mississippi Basin. There's some water that flows out west into the Pacific. And then there's some water that flows north and comes out of the Hudson Bay. And so, you know, you get to see how the environment doesn't really consider the political boundaries that humans place on the map.
Right.
And if the humans can think in a way that is an ecosystem thought process, then we remove the boundaries ourselves, and that creates a much more sustainable management framework, and it allows for sort of the concept of sovereignty of, you know, this is my territory, that's your territory, I'll do what I'm going to do on my side, you do what you're going to do on your side, to kind of be softened. And by thinking from an ecosystem perspective, you can identify areas of cooperation and mutual benefit that don't necessarily exist when you're thinking on a sovereign perspective.
Right. We're sort of running out of time, but sure. I wanted to thank you, Todd, for being on the phone and talking to us from Washington. I've been speaking with Todd Walters. He's the founder and executive director of International Peace Park Expeditions and also the first fellow at the Policy Center for Environment and Peace at Conservation International. And Todd, just thanks for, and I'm going to be speaking with one of your colleagues now at Conservation International just up here. But thank you so much for being on the show.
Well, thank you very much, Stephanie. I enjoyed the opportunity. And I'd be remiss if I didn't mention that your listeners might be interested in learning more about nature's role and the aspects with maintaining human well-being by checking out the Nature is Speaking film series, which they can find on natureisspeaking.org. And it's a phenomenal series of short films that Conservation International has put together that highlights the value of the oceans and the rainforests and the deserts and the ecosystems that are on our planet and why they matter to humanity. So thank you for the opportunity for being able to speak with your listeners, and I look forward to listening to the rest of your program.
Okay, thank you so much. And again, that was natureisspeaking.org?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay, great. Hope people can tune into that.
Thank you, Stephanie.
Thank you.